Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with today's statement from the Republican chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee that the Russians did indeed help elect Trump, contradicting the widely panned opposite conclusion of the House Intelligence Committee, which Trump has celebrated, as well as the release today by the Senate Judiciary Committee of the transcripts of interviews with the participants in the infamous Trump Tower meeting between Trump's inner circle and Russians promising dirt on Hillary Clinton. A former senior State Department official, Max Bergman, the director of the Moscow Project and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, joins us to assess whether there are any more smoking guns in the over 2,000 pages of testimony released today, the most incriminating of which appears to be phone logs that indicate Donald Trump Jr. was communicating with a blocked phone, likely his father's, as though reporting in on the meeting before engaging in follow-up conversations with some of the participants. We will discuss the issue Trump consistently rails against, collusion, which has no legal relevance since the crime is conspiracy against the United States. And if meddling in elections is, as it appears to be, a Russian intelligence operation, Putin would not have wanted or needed to collude with Trump to have achieved the results he got. Then we will speak with Cyrus Farivar, the senior business editor at Ars Technica and author of the new book just out, Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech, and discuss how, as citizens, we are under attack on two fronts from government and big tech companies who have us under more and more surveillance as technology has overrun privacy and the slow pace of legal reform is being eclipsed by the rapid transformation of technology. We will assess what citizens can do to restore protections under the Fourth Amendment in the digital age in which the law desperately needs to catch up with Big Brother. Then finally, we will look into today's surprising and encouraging vote in the U.S. Senate of 52-47, reversing the recent deeply unpopular ruling by the FCC to overturn net neutrality, and speak with Craig Aaron, the managing director at Free Press. We will discuss how his organization and others are leading the grassroots effort to overcome the lobbying power of the big cable and telecom companies who have the House of Representatives and President Trump in their pockets, even though citizens and consumers hate these monopolies providing their cable and internet access as they continue to charge more for less service. And joining us now is Max Bergman, the director of the Moscow Project and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on European security and U.S.-Russia policy. From 2011 to 2017, he served in the U.S. Department of State in a number of different positions, including as a member of the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, where he focused on political, military affairs and nonproliferation, special assistant to the Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, speechwriter to then-Secretary of State John Kerry, and senior advisor to the Assistant Secretary of State for Political and Military Affairs. Welcome to Background Briefing, Max Bergman.
Thank you.
And there was a considerable data dump from the Senate Judiciary Committee today, which I wanted to talk to you about. But I'd like to begin with the statement, for the joint statement, if you will, but particularly from Senator Richard Burr, the Republican chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who today said that Russia did indeed favor Trump in 2016. Of course, that is quite the opposite of what the House Intelligence Committee has concluded. And just to quote Senator Richard Burr, "We see no reason to dispute the intelligence community's conclusions," Senator Burr said in a joint statement today, along with Mark Warner, the vice chair. And he went on to say, "Our staff concluded that the conclusions of the intelligence committee were accurate and on point. The Russian effort was extensive, sophisticated, and ordered by President Putin himself for the purposes of helping Donald Trump and hurting Hillary Clinton." How significant is that to your mind?
I think it's definitely significant, and significant in the sense that, you know, the House Republicans have tried to turn this investigation into a partisan exercise, deliberately trying to warp the facts to try to defend or inoculate the president. And I think what this demonstrates is that, you know, it's not as if the Senate Republicans were sort of eager to jump to this conclusion, but the preponderance of evidence, the facts that were laid out by the intelligence community in its January 2017 report, is so clear in what Russia's objectives were, in the evidence that it provided, that it was going to be impossible, I think, for any fair-minded reading of that report, of what they had done, to conclude otherwise. And so I think this was, you know, frankly, a credibility test for the Senate investigation, for the Senate Intelligence Committee. And I think that the Senate Republicans just thought that there was no way to have any credibility in continuing their investigation if they were going to side with the House Republicans on this. So I think it's incredibly important. It shows that there was there's bipartisan agreement now that the Russians were seeking to help Donald Trump win in the 2016 election, which was the conclusion of the unanimous conclusion of the intelligence community.
Well, we haven't heard from President Trump his response, but he has cheered the House Intelligence Committee report and mentioned it on a number of occasions as if it exonerated him. And of course, we know that the chair, Devin Nunes, was on the Trump transition team and has been peculiarly loyal to the president and seems to have disregarded the role of the Intelligence Committee itself and certainly has ruined its bipartisan tradition. He didn't have a lot to say today, but, you know, Nunes is busy still trying to sabotage the Mueller report by trying to subpoena documents in a fishing expedition, which is unprecedented, in the middle of an investigation to make public what the prosecutor knows is a huge gift to anybody who might be guilty.
Absolutely. And frankly, Devin Nunes should have been removed from the House Intelligence Committee a long time ago by the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan. Devin Nunes, instead of trying to investigate an attack on our democracy by a hostile foreign power, has in effect sought to undermine any the independent investigation that is taking place into that effort, and has sought again and again and again to produce damaging information that about the investigation to try to undercut it and to try to protect the president. And he's been, I think, clearly demonstrated that he's simply a tool of the White House in this. And the fact that the White House would therefore go to such great lengths to try to undermine the investigation, I think, speaks volumes about the concern about what the Mueller investigation will in fact uncover. And what, you know, the damage that Devin Nunes is doing isn't simply to, I think, the credibility of the House of Representatives, the credibility of the Intelligence Community Committee, or to the investigation itself, but it has long-term repercussions. Because the willingness of the intelligence agencies, of the CIA, of the NSA, to share information with Congress is rightly compromised because they don't believe they can trust the motives of the chairman of the committee. And that trust, once a trust is broken between Congress and the intelligence community, it's very hard to build back up. And that applies not just to this investigation, but whether we're talking about, you know, torture reports, or whether we're talking about covert clandestine activities, or about secret intelligence information that the agencies come across that are potentially against the viewpoints of certain congressional members. The willingness to share that information with Congress, which is critical for our democracy, I think is going to be significantly impaired going forward because of the actions of Devin Nunes.
And again, I'm speaking with Max Bergman, the director of the Moscow Project and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on European security and U.S.-Russia policy. From 2011 to 2017, he served in the Department of State in a number of different positions, including as member of the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, where he focused on political, military affairs and nonproliferation, special assistant to the Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, speechwriter to then-Secretary of State John Kerry, and senior advisor to the Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military Affairs. So turning to the over 2,000 pages of testimony that were released today by the Senate Judiciary Committee, what struck you as being, well, dare I use the word smoking gun?
I think what we've learned today is that without any kind of shadow of a doubt, the Trump campaign wanted to collude with the Russians. That was the objective of the meeting, That was why the meeting on June 9th took place. That's why Donald Trump Jr. set up the meeting. That's why he brought Jared Kushner. It's why he brought Paul Manafort, the chairman of the campaign. And so their expectations on the Trump side going into the meeting was that the Russians were going to be providing incredibly damaging information about Hillary Clinton, that the meeting was going to be this collusion. And their kind of justification for the what they say about the meeting after the fact is they say, well, the Russians didn't actually provide us the damaging dirt that we were expecting. In other words, the collusion wasn't good enough. We were expecting better collusion. And I think what the meeting demonstrates to me is that we have to remember the Russians would be very nervous, I think, about actually taking this meeting. They would, you know, this is in operating in the United States for Russia, they're operating in a hostile environment. This is then in a meeting space, it's in Trump Tower, which the Russians then don't control. So the Russians might have thought in some ways they're walking into a bit of a trap. Maybe, you know, the Trump campaign was so eager to set up this meeting, maybe someone called the FBI, and then the FBI would then learn about our broader hacking efforts of the Clinton campaign, of the DNC. So I think the Russians go into the meeting with sort of a good cover story, and I think in the course of that meeting, what they realize is that this meeting isn't a trap. In fact, the Trump campaign is so really wants us to collude. In fact, they're really upset at us that we didn't provide more damaging information, which they in fact possessed, in which they had hacked emails. And so I think what's clear from the document data dump that has been released. Now, there's going to be a lot more tidbits that I think are going to be revealed over the coming days and weeks. But is that the Trump campaign was eager to work with the Russians. And then we know later on the Russians ran a campaign to, in effect, help Donald Trump win. And I think it's very hard to believe that the Russians then weren't willing to work with Donald Trump. Maybe not at that June 9th meeting in particular, but it seems highly likely that the Russians foreshadowed the email hacks that they had done. How did Roger Stone then in August know that John Podesta's, quote, time in the barrel was coming, when John Podesta himself didn't even know he was hacked? And those emails were then released by WikiLeaks in October. So I think this clearly points to will to collude. And I think that preponderance of evidence that has now come out over the past year plus demonstrate that there was collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians. And the question now is, how deep did that collusion go?
So my sense, though, is that there's a couple of really outstanding pieces of journalistic work and historical work have just been released in the form of two books, one by Seth Hettner, a former investigative reporter with the Associated Press, called Trump Russia, and the other one by Timothy Snyder, the Yale historian, The Road to Unfreedom. I think the point that seems to come out of that, to my mind, is that we should stop using this word collusion, which, of course, is Donald Trump's favorite word, saying there's no collusion. If there is a law that's been broken, it is called conspiracy against the United States, and that's what Manafort is facing charges on. So that said, my sense is that, in effect, the evidence seems to be pointing in the direction that President Trump or Donald Trump at the time, you know, we know about 2008, he started to get money from Russia. He was blackballed by the U.S. banks for taking them down for enormous amounts of money from his failed casinos. In 1987, he made a trip with his then-wife, Ivana, who spoke Russian and was his translator. He tried to get a meeting with Gorbachev, but he ended up meeting with an awful lot of intelligence people, whether he knew it or not. And he clearly has been on their radar for some time, as was his wife, because she took the kids every year to Czechoslovakia, then a part of the Warsaw Pact, every summer. So they've had sort of long-standing, perhaps, shall we say, cultural ties, leaving aside the political component. But my sense is that with Putin being an intelligence officer, a successful operation like the one that he conducted, in effect, it makes sort of Donald Trump almost like a Russian bot. that he's sort of a zombie on autopilot, and he doesn't even know that he's colluding, because Putin has laid the groundwork, in a sense, after Trump's meeting in the Nobu restaurant in Moscow in 2013. He immediately returned to the United States and started this idea that Obama was not an American citizen. He was a Kenyan. He was an interloper. And that whole racist canard was pushed, and the birther movement was born. And in effect, you could make the case that the constituency that Trump has today was also born at that moment. And I'm sure Putin's attitude was he hated Obama, and this was perfect to divide America and make life miserable for Obama. And then as you get into the general, the same in 2016, the same applies. It didn't mean that Putin thought that Trump was going to win, but either way, it was a win-win for Putin, because if Trump lost, since he'd laid the groundwork that the elections were a fraud and rigged, he'd be running around the country today having rallies every day, chanting, lock her up, lock her up. So again, he would be dividing America, whether he's in the office or not. So that's the way I see it. I don't know whether you agree with that.
Yeah, no, I think when we think about Russia's motives, it was, you know, post-2014, post-Ukraine, where Russia invades Ukraine, seizes Crimea, and then suddenly there's Western sanctions up against Russia. Putin is seeking to hit back against the West, against the United States, against Europe, for these sanctions, but he has a problem, and that is Russia's fairly weak, actually, that its economy isn't strong enough. It can't really do retaliatory sanctions. It has nothing that, you know, if it tries to sanction Western goods that are being sold in Russia, it doesn't have a real impact, that much of an impact on us. And so he looks to exploit the openness of our democratic societies. And so this is about sowing discord. This is also about building extremist candidates on the far right and the far left. And it's not just in the United States, but in France and with Marine Le Pen, and then other figures throughout Europe. And so Donald Trump perfectly fits that mold. And I think you're right to point to his business ties, because what do Trump's business ties sort of establish? Well, they both establish a certain level of dependency on Russian money, that Trump's businesses are without Russian money, without being in the good graces of the Kremlin and of Russian oligarch class, it really hurt his businesses. So it establishes both a relationship as well as a dependency. And then when Trump runs for office during the primary, we see that inexplicably Trump is the only Republican candidate out of the 16 that says very positive things about Russia, that wants to establish good relationships with Putin. And that is something that is totally, you know, against Trump's political interest to do, but he says it anyway. And then we learn that Trump's trying to build the Trump Tower in Moscow, that they're trying to negotiate this deal as he's doing this. So the mix of kind of Trump's business interests with where he is politically, I think we see going back. But I think when it comes to your point about the collusion, I definitely take your point that collusion is not a legal term. It is conspiracy against the United States. But I think what we'll end up seeing, and I think this is probably still to come, is that the hack and release of emails by Russian intelligence is going to be one of a major plank of the Mueller investigation. Now, he hasn't yet brought indictments related to the hacking. I think this will come. But what we know happened is that Russian intelligence hacked the email account of John Podesta and the DNC. The Russian intelligence then tells the Trump campaign that they have thousands of emails. George Papadopoulos, who gets this information, then tells people in the Trump campaign that they have dirt on Hillary Clinton. They then meet multiple times to where it's impossible to believe that this isn't discussed. And then the Trump campaign knows ahead of time that this is happening, that Roger Stone knows that the emails are going to be released, and they establish back channels to WikiLeaks, the conduit for the Russian release of emails. And then, most importantly, I think, is the Trump campaign then bases their campaign strategy in the final month of the campaign around the released the stolen emails. Trump mentions WikiLeaks 164 times the final month of the campaign, five times a day, and they are able to sort of, in a way that's incredibly adept, pull out some of these emails like a needle in a haystack and weaponize them during the final month of the campaign, such as on Catholic voters, to target them in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. So that's what collusion would look like during, you know, that if you were going to work with a hostile foreign intelligence service, that's exactly what you use them for, to hack your opponent, to get advanced warning, and then base your campaign around it. And though I think it's a very hard story for the American public to sort of comprehend, but when you think about Trump's business ties, when you think that's how the relationship sort of starts, and then why Russia's trying to hit back at us, that I think it all sort of becomes quite clear. And let's also be clear, the Russians didn't think Trump was going to win. Trump didn't think he was going to win. No one thought he was going to win. But they thought they were building up a powerful force that was going to be cause a real problem for President Hillary Clinton, that was going to build a real force for discord. And in fact, Trump was ready. The Russians were readying this sort of bot campaign to say the system's rigged at the end of the election. So they were ready to attack American democracy sort of right after the election. They pulled that down. Why? Because Trump ended up victorious. So I think what we have here is, you know, a very complicated story, a story that goes back decades. But on the one hand, it's also very simple. A man who is corrupt in his business dealings, was corrupt in how he ran his campaign, and therefore was willing to do whatever it took to get ahead, was willing to work with the Russians. Why wouldn't he work with the Russians? If you're nervous, if you're willing to do money laundering and violate, you know, those sorts of financial laws, then you're not going to be that concerned about federal election law. And I think that's sort of the clear story that we're seeing played out, but is also playing out in the way he's running his current administration in terms of his propensity to accept corruption, to tolerate it, that it sort of seems to proliferate sort of everywhere throughout his administration.
Well, just in closing, though, the point I was making, Max, is that as an intelligence operation, particularly coming from the top, the head of the country, Putin, who actually encourages competition between the GRU and the FSB. Yeah. The SVR didn't seem to have a lot to do with this one. I think the more seasoned people like Sergei Ivanov and others tried to warn Putin against meddling in the U.S. election. They thought there'd be blowback, but Putin was determined. And so if you run a good intelligence operation, you don't need collusion. I don't know whether Trump is the polyezhny delurak, the idea of a useful idiot, or he is in collusion, but to my mind, it doesn't matter if he's a useful idiot or if he's in collusion. The table was set by Putin, and he was targeted, he was corrupt, he was a perfect person to be recruited by the Russians, and I think at the end of the day, that's what Americans can't get their heads around, is the idea that a foreign power manipulated the United States to the extent that they put their guy in the White House. That's a really hard thing to people get their heads around. And I assume at the end of the day, that's what we will learn from Mueller.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that part of the June 9th revelations, the revelations we're seeing today from the Senate Judiciary Committee, I think further confirm that the motivations, the depravity of the Trump campaign. Now, the thing is, when learning about that the Russians hacking and the Russians had incriminating information, the first thing that the Trump campaign should have done, and any campaign would have done, is contact the FBI. But the less acceptable but still somewhat okay sort of a fallback option is to do nothing, is to avoid contact with the Russians. Okay, you know there's going to be dirt coming, but you're going to avoid contact with the Russian. That, at least, you could say, well, they were trying to avoid any legal liability. The Trump campaign does the opposite of that. They actually try to meet with the Russians, to get the dirt, to engage with them. So I think what we're seeing with this, you know, latest document reveal is that it wasn't just that they were passive beneficiaries of Russian hacking, but they were actively encouraging it and actively wanted to partake and participate in it. And so I think you're right that we sort of have enough to know their kind of the depths of their depravity. But I think I think that's what Mueller, through his investigation, is ultimately going to reveal. And it's, I think, for those tracking this, it won't actually be that shocking. I don't think I'll be that shocked at the end of the day. But I think the American public will find it an absolute shock, the level to which the Trump campaign and the Trump organization was willing to stoop.
Well, Max Bergman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Great. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Max Bergman, the director of the Moscow Project and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, where he focuses on European security and U.S.-Russian policy. From 2011 to 2017, he served in the United States Department of State in a number of different positions, including as member of the Secretary of State's policy planning staff, where he focused on political and military affairs and nonproliferation, senior assistant to the Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, speechwriter to then-Secretary of State John Kerry, and senior advisor to the Assistant Secretary of State for Political Military affairs. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how citizens are under attack on two fronts from government and big tech companies who have us under more and more surveillance. You can't hide. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Cyrus Farivar, the senior business editor at Ars Technica and the author of The Internet Elsewhere. He is also a radio producer and has reported for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, National Public Radio, Public Radio International, The Economist, Wired, New York Times, and others. And his latest book just out is Habeas Data, Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. Welcome to Background Briefing, Cyrus Farivar.
Thank you.
And habeas corpus, of course, is a pillar of the law. It's a writ requiring a person under arrest to be brought before a judge or into court, especially to secure the person's release unless lawful grounds are shown for their detention. How do you apply, clearly you're using that as a kind of pun, if you will, how does that apply to habeas data?
Well, so there is actually a legal doctrine that exists in a number of other countries. It does not exist in the United States. That is known as the writ of habeas data. It exists in Latin America, in the Philippines. It has its origins in Germany as well. This is the idea of having individuals having the right to go to not only any government agency to ask for data or information held about them, but also private companies as well. And this is a right that we don't have in the United States currently. So my book, the title of the book is meant not only to sort of allude to this fact, this kind of difference in the law, but also to, you know, as you say, make a nod towards the fact that it is a book about legal issues. My book does talk about what the writ of habeas data means in a strict legal sense. But my book overall is much more broader than that.
So at this point, though, it seems that we citizens are getting it hit from both directions, both from the government and from private industry, particularly with these revelations from what Cambridge Analytica was up to in the 2016 elections. And today, before the Senate, there was testimony from the Cambridge Analytica whistleblower, Christopher Wiley, about how Bannon wanted to use the power of data to stir up the culture wars, and we don't know the extent to which Cambridge Analytica was successful, or the Republicans who were using Cambridge Analytica were successful in getting Trump elected. But there's certainly a component to the overall picture that also, of course, involves Vladimir Putin and the special prosecutor Mueller and his investigation. But are we to accept the premise that we're getting hit from both sides, from the government itself, and then from these big data companies and these big, powerful tech companies, five of which are about the biggest corporations on the planet?
I mean, there's certainly an element of concern when it comes to privacy. You know, there's certainly the private component and foreign actors as well. What my book really focuses on is the use of surveillance technology by government agencies here in America, and focuses on how our laws and our case law and our Supreme Court precedents over the last 50 years, you know, are, or maybe in some cases are not, adequate with the technological circumstances in which we find ourselves today.
So it's pretty clear that technology has overrun privacy, and that there's a huge gap between the slow pace of legal reform and the rapid transformation of technology. But lately, I've noticed, for example, in Russia and in Iran, there have been massive street demonstrations about efforts on the part of the government to shut down a social media platform, Telegram. So what's the difference between, say, Russia and Iran and the U.S.? Russia and Iran clearly want to know everything that their citizens are doing. Is the same true here in America, that the National Security Agency and other intelligence services in the United States want to know everything that we as citizens are doing?
I would like to believe that that is not the case. I would like to believe that you know, the National Security Agency and other agencies are trying to protect the nation against terrorism, and I think that they're trying to do that in the most aggressive and lawful way that they can. That being said, I am troubled by programs, you know, like, for example, the NSA's Section 215 metadata program, which ran from 2001 to 2015 and continues today in a modified form. And it was first kind of made publicly known by Edward Snowden in 2013, right? This is the program that captures all of our telephone metadata, you know, who called who, when and what day for how long. And this is in the name of fighting terrorism, as a way to determine, you know, what terroristic links can be found by digging through phone records. And I think a lot of us are maybe a little bit disturbed by the fact that the government successfully convinced the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court, to use a legal precedent from the 1970s, known as the third party doctrine, which I read about in the book. And that case, that doctrine came from a case called Smith versus Maryland, which involves a late night mugging in the streets of Baltimore, and how the police were able to obtain without a warrant phone records for one guy, one robber, effectively, 3 days of his phone records. And the FISA court judge ruled that it held that, you know, if it was true that this robber did not have a privacy interest in his phone records over 3 days, then it followed that no American has any privacy interest over their phone records. And so that's what validates the NSA's metadata program. And, you know, I think I and many other Americans find that a little bit troubling.
Well, we know that the business model for Google and Facebook is referred to nowadays as surveillance capitalism, and that enormous amounts of data are collected on us as individuals, and it's monetized, and we get nothing from it. In fact, we become the product.
Well, it's not. I would disagree with that premise. We do get something from it, because, I mean, we may not get something financially, but we do get some sort of utility out of it, right? A lot of us, Facebook has 2 billion users worldwide, right? They obviously get something out of using the product. A lot of us use Google services. We use Google and Gmail and stuff. And, you know, yeah, we may not like the fact that they are profiting off of that, but we do get some utility.
And again, I'm speaking with Cyrus Farivar, who is a senior business editor at Ars Technica and the author of The Internet Elsewhere. He's also a radio producer and has reported for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, National Public Radio, Public Radio International, The Economist, Wired, The New York Times, and others. And his latest book just out is Habeas Data, Privacy Versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. So just to return to the alarming fact that there's a growing gap between the slow pace of legal reform and the rapid transformation of technology. What kind of technology is out there now? We know, for example, in the UK, if you watch, you know, British crime dramas on Netflix, you find out that so much of what the police are doing are looking at CCTV, which is ubiquitous. So that's just one example. What other examples can you give us to scare the hell out of us, Cyrus?
So, you know, many cities in America, including the city where I live, Oakland, California, police have a technology called license plate readers. These are specialized cameras that are typically mounted on top of police cars that can scan license plates at speeds up to 60 plates per second. I just wrote a story for Ars Technica, in fact, this morning mentioned the fact that there's a whole new generation of license plate readers that are now coming up. Rather than only recording the license plate number and the date and time and location at which a given plate was seen, these cameras are now able to record other physical information about a car. Does it have a roof rack? Does it have a spare tire that's visible? Does it have certain bumper stickers? What kind of car is it? What color is it? Various other kinds of things that, you know, previously were, you know, not as, you know, not possible through any other type of machine, or to be collected by a person nearly with the same speed or volume as this type of device can do.
Well, for example, I mentioned the use of CCTV to solve crimes, and that seems to be more and more on the rise. And also, a major crime here in the state of California was just recently solved through DNA, through commercial DNA gatherers, you know, like these ancestry type operations. And this really bad guy has been caught, and many, many murders have been solved, and rapes, etc. So how do you navigate that, the fact that this new technology is helping solve crimes and catch criminals, at the same time it has the potential to be abused?
Yeah, and I think that's a question that we all need to kind of wrestle with, and our lawmakers need to wrestle with, whether that it's at the city council level, at the county level, the state level, the federal level. I think we all need to think about where the appropriate line is, right? This is a question that is as old as our republic, right? The fact that we have a Fourth Amendment to begin with, I think, is suggestive of the fact that our founders were very concerned about the potential abuse and overreach of government power, right? If you read the Bill of Rights, you know, the First Amendment talks about the right, you know, the right to free speech shall not be infringed, right? The Second Amendment talks about the First Amendment talks about Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. And the Second Amendment talks about the rights of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The Third Amendment, which is one that a lot of people forget, talks about that the government cannot quarter soldiers in a person's home. And the Fourth Amendment, of course, protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures. So if you look at these collectively, I think it's easy to understand that our founders were very concerned about the government's ability to sort of run amok and get out of hand. I think that there is, you know, it is easy to understand that if you have all kinds of tools, right, whether it's drones or license plate readers or body cameras or DNA scanning or anything else, that we probably would solve a lot more crime. But there has to be a balance between the interests of law enforcement and the interests of civil liberties. And that's something that is a very tricky balance. And I think that, you know, it's probably true that if we were running DNA scans on everybody and we had video cameras inside everyone's home and outside everyone's home, and we took a bunch of other, you know, surveillance measures, we probably would reduce, you know, crime in this country. But I think if we were to do that, that would make a lot of people very uncomfortable. So I agree, it is a tricky balance.
But already commercial technology seems to be invading people's privacy. And again, it's rather like what we were talking earlier about surveillance capitalism. We get services in exchange for giving up our privacy to private entities who then can monetize it. Gmail is free, but we do pay a price. But don't we have also in homes now these devices like Alexa, Google Home, and Siri, essentially are surveillance devices?
Well, I mean, like to take Alexa is Amazon's product, right? As a home assistant, right? But I would say there's a big difference between, first of all, the Fourth Amendment and the U.S. Constitution has nothing to say about what private companies do, right? What Amazon or Google or anybody else does against us, right? The Fourth Amendment and the Constitution is designed to protect us from our own government. So I think it's important to keep that in mind. You know, you're choosing to put an Alexa in your home. You're choosing to use Gmail, and you're choosing to use Facebook or any other services or products, right? Nobody's forcing you to do that. you know, you can choose not to. There are, you know, email alternatives besides Gmail. Gmail is probably one of the better and more popular ones, but it is not certainly the only one. You know, same with some of these, you know, home digital devices, right? We choose to bring them into our homes or into our lives. When we're out on the street, right, I didn't choose for the Oakland Police Department to scan my license plate, and yet I know that they have because I filed public records requests that show that they did do that, right? I didn't ask the police to have body cameras in Oakland or in other, again, body cameras are very common in many parts of America now. You know, and I certainly didn't ask for a technology that is going to be here, I think, a lot sooner than many people realize, which is, you know, facial recognition. And the body cameras that exist on police officers today are very, very soon going to have facial recognition capabilities and routinely being able to scan people's faces, just as police routinely scan license plates now.
So presumably that would mean that a policeman walking around with a body cam in a crowded street or in a mall or something, the device could pick up a signal of facial recognition and that person could be arrested on the spot?
Yeah, and not only that. I mean, it's important to remember that, you know, it's not just scanning for, you know, suspects or wanted criminals or people like that, fugitives or whatever. It's also just scanning ordinary, you know, law-abiding, tax-paying citizens like you and me, right? You know, for license plate readers, for example, the what's called the hit rate, which is to say the number of successful hits, right, scans of license plates that match the police's database divided by the total number of scans, in every case that I've ever looked at is less than 1%, oftentimes less than 0.5%. In Oakland, it's something like 0.2%. It's an extremely small percentage, right? So the overwhelming majority of scans are of just regular people's cars going about their business. And I would imagine that facial recognition would be the same. You know, a lot of us, I think, would be very uncomfortable if the police had a record of the fact that we were seen at certain places at certain times doing nothing but engaging in lawful, normal, everyday activity, even if it's activity that we would perhaps wish to keep private, such as, you know, going to a sex toy shop or going to a marijuana dispensary or going to a religious service or going to a gun store or going to, you know, Planned Parenthood or to a doctor's office or, you know, any number of things that are normal, regular, everyday, lawful activities.
Well, as much as I fear the government having this ability, I also fear private industry having the ability. I mean, insurance companies that can find out whether you have pre-existing conditions, in loan applications, looking into your private life. You know, and you mentioned if you go to a pot shop or something, divorces, all kinds of stuff can be used against people. Technology is kind of weaponizing. We've seen how people's reputations can be quickly destroyed. And I'm not suggesting it's not deserved in terms of the Me Too movement and others. But we are entering an era, are we not, of weaponized information being used against people.
Yeah, I mean, again, literally today, the Attorney General of California has filed criminal charges against the operators of a website called mugshots.com, which is publishing criminal mugshots of people who have not even, in some cases, been formally prosecuted or, you know, convicted of a crime. These are people that have just been arrested for whatever reason. And this company, mugshots.com, has this whole service that some people, I think, would call extortion, where you can pay money to have your photo removed, because obviously being arrested is often quite embarrassing and having your mugshot posted on the internet is quite embarrassing. And so, yeah, I agree. There's a whole slew of private companies, some of whom are more reputable than others, that certainly, you know, offer new challenges for our privacy today.
Well, Saras Varavara, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Saras Varavara, who's a senior business editor at Ars Technica and the author of The Internet Elsewhere. He's also a radio producer and has reported for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, National Public Radio, Public Radio International, The Economist, Wired, and The New York Times. In his latest book, just out, is Habeas Data, Privacy Versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into today's surprising and encouraging vote in the U.S. Senate reversing the recent deeply unpopular ruling by the FCC to overturn net neutrality.
future.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Craig Aaron, who is the Managing Director at Free Press and is the editor and co-author of Changing Media, Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizen's Congress Watch. Welcome to Background Briefing, Craig Aaron.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
Well, thanks, Craig. And your organization, Free Press, had its Free Press Action Fund, Fight for the Future, and Demand Progress as well, joining forces. And you had a big win today. You've been lobbying heavily to repeal the decision to repeal net neutrality by Chairman Pai of the FCC. And the Senate today voted. They voted 52-47 in favor of a resolution of disapproval that would overturn the FCC's unpopular 2017 repeal of net neutrality protections. And joining the 49 Democrats were Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, and John Kennedy of Louisiana. So I imagine you feel good about it, but it's a pretty uphill battle from now on, isn't it, with the House and with Trump?
I mean, it certainly is. We do feel good. I think this is a huge win. You know, we've been counted out on net neutrality many times before, and certainly the Trump FCC moving in December to eliminate the rules we fought for almost a decade to pass during the Obama administration was a huge blow, but it also awakened an incredible groundswell of public opposition. And I think you saw the results of that today in the Senate, because let's not forget, the Senate is a Republican-controlled body as well. And, you know, now one that has seen bipartisan support for overturning what the FCC did, which is pretty remarkable for a Republican-controlled Senate to rebuke a Republican agency like they did today. So we're really hoping to capitalize on that momentum. There's no question that we face a steep climb in the House, but we also know this is an issue that's broken through in ways that we simply haven't seen before. I mean, I've been fighting for net neutrality for more than 10 years, and the level of public awareness, interest, those people willing to take action isn't like anything we've seen before. Things have broken through. This has become something that's really mobilizing people in this Trump era. And I think we're seeing the results. And so I think when we bring that to the House, a House that is certainly worried about the upcoming election, this is an issue that's become incredibly popular, especially among young people. We think we can really begin to move those votes. I'm sure that the phone and cable companies will try to throw up obstacles. There'll be all sorts of procedural moves to try to keep a net neutrality vote from happening. But, you know, that's a fight that we're actually excited to be in. Because, again, time and again over this fight, you know, going back to 2005, 2006, we've been told, you know, you're not going to get what you want. It's not possible. Give up. Compromise. And we've pushed back and gotten results. And today is an important chapter in that story.
Well, isn't it true, though, Craig Aaron, that many of the states that are most affected by the repeal of net neutrality by the FCC are rural states, which are largely red states? And that was, in fact, Lisa Murkowski's argument today.
That's right. I think that one of the reasons that net neutrality has appeal and one of the reasons that so many people have been speaking out in places where you don't necessarily see a lot of political protest, Alaska, Louisiana, some of these other states, even where senators didn't do the right thing today, Colorado, Nevada, is that because in a lot of these places, the choices when it comes to broadband are so limited. You know, for most of us, we're lucky if we have two choices for high-speed internet access. And if both companies decide they're going to violate net neutrality and discriminate online, there's really nowhere else to go. But the more rural you get, the further from the coast you get, really the fewer choices there are. And I think you saw both from Senator Murkowski in Alaska and Senator Kennedy in Louisiana, you know, really strong statements about, you know, look, I would love to not do this, but my choice is, you know, trust the cable company or don't, and I don't trust the cable company. That's basically what Senator Kennedy said today. And I think the experience for so many people in urban and rural areas, but especially in rural areas, you know, finding a lack of access in communities all across the country, you know, these cable and phone companies are among the most hated for a reason. And that's that people aren't getting good service. They're feeling ripped off.
And we've built a system where the incentives aren't for these companies to serve their customers. They're to come up with ways to take advantage of their market dominance, of the scarcity that they enjoy for their product. And people are really paying attention to that. And politicians are being forced to pay attention because this is an issue that's showing up in their polling. They're hearing about it when they're back in their districts. And, you know, people don't trust the phone and cable companies, and they don't think they're getting the service that they deserve. And they can feel their communities falling behind, in some cases the rest of the country or the rest of the world, because they're not enjoying access to everything that they want. And that's what's been so interesting about working on an issue like net neutrality, where it hasn't broken down along partisan lines. I mean, even if you read the right-wing press, they might be in line with the phone and cable companies. But go down in those comment threads on a website like Breitbart, and you'll see people very confused because they want the free and open internet to stay that way, even if their, you know, politics are more conservative.
And again, I'm speaking with Craig Aaron, who's the managing director at Free Press and the editor and co-author of Changing Media Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. Before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizens Congress Watch. And we're talking about the what seems to be a surprise vote in the Senate today, 52-47, to overturn the overturning, if you will, of net neutrality protections by the FCC under Ajit Pai. And of course, the House is in the thrall of the libertarian billionaires like the Koch brothers and others. I don't know for the life of me why the Koch brothers, who talk about freedom all the time, freedom is their mantra, why they want monopolies. When you say that these cable companies can't be trusted, I think the more accurate word is that they're hated. Consumers hate them.
Yeah.
They're just terrible. They charge you more and more for less and less. And it's a complete embarrassment. The country that invented the internet is going further and further behind every day in terms of global competition in broadband. We're lucky to get, what's the national average? 9 megabytes per second or something pathetic, when you get a gigabyte in South Korea and Japan and in France. And, it's embarrassing what they're offering up for lots and lots of money.
And I think this is where it does come back to policy decisions. And the United States decided to abandon competition policy, a more competitive system with lots of choices. You can think all the way back to those days of dial-up, or some listeners might still remember. And you had a lot of choices, 5 or 6 different choices for having your internet service. And prices went down. We all know that our cable bills only go in one direction, up and up some more. So even as speeds and services have improved in the United States, what you see happening is that it becomes out of reach financially. And even though this service is essential, if you want to connect and communicate in the modern era, people are having to make really tough choices about their family's budgets, their family's expenses. And because these big companies don't face meaningful competition, they also don't have to pay any attention to customer service. They're looking for ways to, nickel and dime their customers, add on hidden fees, interfere with content, none of which is what their customers want. I mean, what most people want is a big pipe coming to their house, giving them what they want to watch when they want to watch it, websites they want to visit. And they don't want a middleman, an intermediary, deciding for them which sites are going to work and which won't. And I think that's one of the reasons this sort of once obscure issue of net neutrality has really caught hold, because so much of our daily experience is now tied up in that internet connection, whether you're at your house or you're using your smartphone. And it's become that important to people, whether they're finding work, starting their own businesses, doing political organizing. These tools have become invaluable. And the big companies that we rely on, and really all we're asking for is a fair price and get out of the way, keep wanting to interfere, find these other advantages, favor their own content and services. And it's overwhelmingly rejected by people. I mean, the polls show net neutrality is an issue supported by, 85% of Americans across the political spectrum. And I think politicians are starting to wake up to that fact and realize that they have found themselves on the wrong side of this for all the reasons that I'm sure you've talked about a million times before: the corruption of the political system, the campaign finance system, all the money these companies pump into Washington, D.C. But it's really started to catch up with them. And I think that you've seen these companies making these massive overreaches, looking for these special favors, and now being met with real opposition and resistance that never existed in this space or on issues like this before. They've broken through, and that starts to create a political opportunity, one that, you know, politicians really have to pay attention to.
Net neutrality
has gone from an issue at the margins to one that's showing up in the polling of all these members of Congress. Sure. They're hearing about from their kids, and that's completely changed the political calculus in a way that actually leaves me optimistic. Even though we're in the Trump administration, even though there's challenges in the House, that all the trends are toward actually getting these policies right.
But just in the last minute, what can be done to get the Trump to change his mind? He ran as a populist, the champion of the little guy, wanted to drain the swamp. Everything that he's protecting and the House is protecting is the swamp and big money from the telecoms. And the people want a net neutrality, and they want everything that we've talked about. So, and also, it's crippling America's competitive advantage. As a businessman, he ought to recognize that.
Well, I think we have to force him to have to make the choice. And the key to doing that is passing legislation in the House of Representatives. We need 218 votes. I know we've got at least 160 co-sponsors of the bill. I can count up to 30 or 35 more people I'm pretty confident will vote for it. So we're talking about 25 Republicans in the House that we need to find in the next few weeks willing to support the free and open Internet. That should be very doable in a hotly contested election year. And if the House can pass this legislation and we can avoid the procedural hurdles that the Republican leadership will throw up, then we're going to have the opportunity to win this fight. I can't predict what Donald Trump will do from one day to the next. So I'm willing to take that bet and say, if we put a bill on his plate, maybe he just lets it go through. Maybe he doesn't, and we're having a fight over a veto. I, for one, welcome that fight. And I think, you know, this is an issue that's become so popular that if you're sitting somewhere like Donald Trump is sitting, doing so many things that are unpopular, maybe this is the fight you don't want to pick. I don't know. I think the best thing we can do is get there, and that means going through the House of Representatives, and that's the next step.
Well, Craig Aaron, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Craig Aaron, who's the Managing Director at Free Press and is the editor and co-author of Changing Media Public Interest Policies for the Digital Age. And before joining Free Press, he was an investigative reporter for Public Citizens Congress Watch. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by